Welcome to Prophecy Radio, the Percy Jackson podcast that will keep you up to date on all things Rick Riordan and Rick Riordan Presents, including upcoming books, adaptations, and more. This is episode number 65. My name is Karen, and I'm joined by...
Kristen!
I gave you some finger gun introduction.
That's right.
Yeah.
I like the finger guns.
And if you listened to last week's episode, you know that we recorded these back-to-back. I am parting the veil on the magic of podcasting, and that we are skipping the news this week so that we could do a news roundup next week, and so that this will hopefully be shorter because we are on holiday right now.
Yeah, we're gonna take a little break, but we're not gonna make you guys take a break.
Yes.
So we're recording a few ahead of time and getting ahead of the game.
Yeah. If you would like to contact us, you can do so at Prophecy Podcast on Twitter, at Prophecy Radio Podcast on Tumblr, Instagram, and Facebook, and Prophecy Radio Podcast at gmail.com. This week, we are talking about the Lightning Thief Illustrated Edition and the graphic novel at the same time, because they're not dissimilar,
yeah,
you know, in a lot of ways, and I think it actually ended up being really cool to be able to, like, compare and contrast them, and so I'm very excited to get into this because I've had both for a long time, and it's been a really long time since I've ever looked through them, so it was just nice to revisit them. You didn't own either one of them, right?
Correct.
And this is your first time really looking at them?
Yeah, for the most part, yeah. I feel like I have looked at the illustrated edition once before. Like, maybe I was at a bookstore and I looked through it or something.
Okay.
Like, there were parts of it that kind of felt familiar to me. But I do not own it, which I'll have to rectify sometime soon. And I did not, like, I have never read it, like, sat down and read the whole thing, so.
I want to start with the Lightning Thief Illustrated Edition, which was published in 2018, and it was illustrated by John Rocco, which, I mean, we've talked about John Rocco a million times. His art is incredible. For me, he is just iconic Percy Jackson art. I know that we've had, like, Viria, and we've had a lot of other artists do Percy Jackson art. And even now, people redoing the Percy Jackson covers for, you know, updated editions and everything like that. And they're all wonderful. But, like, this is classic Percy Jackson, John
yeah.
Rocco. So I'm so glad that he did the illustrated edition,
mm-hmm.
and I thought it was really cool that in the back of this book, he said, "The artist would like to thank Lucas, Paloma, and Val for acting out the adventures of Grover, Annabeth, and Percy. The artwork in this book was created with pencil, watercolor, and digital paint." And I just thought that was cool that he probably had some, I don't know if those are his kids or just people
yeah.
he knows, act out what the poses would be and stuff like that. That's really funny. And the different mediums with pencil, watercolor, and digital paint, I think is really cool.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, as we learned recently, there are no current plans for any more illustrated editions. And I was already bummed out, but I'm even more bummed out now that we are going through this again because
yeah.
it's just so beautiful.
I really would, I'm, you know, with Rick, we always say never,
yeah.
and I'd like to believe that this reinvigorated interest in the series because of the show, that Disney will say, we need to do those.
Mm-hmm.
Because, like, with the Harry Potter illustrated editions, it's not like a thing that is brand new or anything, but it's a thing to look forward to. It's a thing to own. If you're a big fan of the series, like, it's nice to have them and
mm-hmm.
look at these, you know, crazy, fun illustrations of all these moments. So I'm hoping
yeah.
that with the show will come a new interest in getting us the rest of the illustrated editions and maybe some more graphic novels. We'll see.
Yeah. Basically, we have to prove to Disney Publishing that it's worth it for them to put out the illustrated editions. I don't know how to do that other than, like, we just keep buying the first one because, who knows, maybe they'll take a chance on a second one. But, you know, like you said, Harry Potter has put out several illustrated editions. I know they have at least four. I don't know if they...
I'm pretty sure Order of the Phoenix came out either this year or last year.
Oh,
so,
okay.
like, they're still... I think they're still working on them.
Yeah. That tells me that they do sell. And so if Harry Potter can sell, then hopefully Percy Jackson will sell, especially because I know a lot of people are kind of leaving the Harry Potter fandom for the Percy Jackson fandom, so... Well,
and they make really good gifts. They're not usually super expensive. Like, I think the Harry Potter ones were usually somewhere in the $30 to $40 range. So, like, it's not a crazy expensive gift, but it's... You know, it's a good size present for a birthday or a Christmas or something. So hopefully, maybe there's a possibility we could hopefully see some in the future.
Yeah, I hope so. Because this book is so dynamic. Like, the book itself, the story is so good, but it's really enhanced by all of John Rocco's artwork. And I just had some, like, random observations as I was going through the book that I wanted to talk about. And the first was that there's a map in the front of Camp Half-Blood, and in the back, it's of their trip across the United States. And there is a full-color Camp Half-Blood map on the inside as well. And I, in particular, love books that come with maps. Mm-hmm. And I think that a lot of people have done their own renditions of Camp Half-Blood and how it's set up in the past. But it's really cool to see John Rocco's version, the quote-unquote official version of what Camp Half-Blood would look like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, oh yeah, for sure. I mean, you can kind of picture it with, like, the horseshoe shape of the cabins and, like, some of that stuff. But it's hard to kind of place the entire... For me, I can see, like, visions of... You know, the lake and the beachfront, and, like, I can see the Colosseum, but, like, kind of getting an idea of how they relate to each other space-wise has always been hard for me. So it is nice to kind of get a map or get an idea of what the layout of camp kind of looks like. Mm-hmm. And granted, there can probably, like, 17 million of these, you know, people do their own or whatever, but it's nice to get one in the illustrated edition from John Rocco, like, here's what... It looks like.
Yeah, and it'll be very interesting to compare that to what we see in the show.
Absolutely.
Because I will say, his version of the cabins, they looked very small. They looked tiny, and we know that the ones in the show are going to be quite big, so I'm very excited about that.
Yeah, absolutely.
The other thing I really, really loved about this book was that there are a ton of illustrations. Like, we get a bunch of full-page ones, but there's a lot of small things in the corners, whether it's a character or, like, a weapon or just a little design. And a lot of the pages come with, like, backgrounds and decorations. There's, like, water sprayed across the page, or, like, it'll look like gravel, or just some, like, modeling on a page that makes it different than a blank white page. There aren't a lot of blank white pages with text in this illustrated edition, and usually those come opposite a full color, full page illustration. So I thought that was really cool, and it shows that they've put a lot of thought and a lot of effort into designing this book to be very visual and very enticing.
Yeah, agreed, yeah. And I mean, there's so many really good moments, especially like in Lightning Thief, but in each of these books, that... Yeah, there's some really powerful visuals that you're like, yeah, that's going to make a really cool, like, illustration. So I would imagine all of those big moments, like, those are the ones that you're getting these full color illustrations for. You're going to get the Minotaur, like, you know, and trying to get to Camp Half-Blood. Like,
those action shots that are, like, the climax of whatever chapter.
Yeah, absolutely.
Speaking of little illustrations, though, I did notice that at the end of chapter one, there is a little illustration of, like, a trident and stuff. And I was like, that's kind of a spoiler. Like, I think most people picking up the illustrated edition, this is not the first time they're reading the story. But, like, if it was, you'd be like, oh, why is Poseidon's weapon at the end of chapter one? That's suspicious.
Yeah.
So I was like, I maybe wouldn't have done that, but that's okay. And another surprising thing I noticed was that Chiron is a white stallion in this, which is funny because I swear when we were talking about it before, whatever website I was reading off of mentioned that in the graphic novel, the movie, and the illustrated edition, that Chiron was a brown stallion. But this is the one instance where he's been portrayed as a white stallion, and I thought that was pretty interesting.
Yeah, I mean, it is the description. We learned that a couple weeks ago, and it's, that's fun. That there is one in which he appears as a white stallion and not as a brown or, you know, tan-colored pony.
But I still kind of like him as a brown stallion. I think it just, with his brown hair, it just makes sense to me.
Yeah. No, I get that.
Yeah. And also, important to note, is that you cannot see Ares's motorcycle seat made of human skin. I was a little disappointed. I wanted to know what it looked like from John Rocco's mind.
Yeah, that's a little... Hmm.
But maybe it's for the best.
Even he is like, no.
Yeah.
I can't do it. I just can't do it.
Yeah.
No. I will say I have one, it's not really like a favorite illustration, but it was something that jumped out at me when I was taking my scroll through this. It's toward the beginning. I believe it's when Mr. Brunner slash Chiron first gives Percy his pen.
Yeah.
There is, in the middle of the page, a full illustration of this ballpoint pen. And I want this from Disney.
Yeah.
Like, this is all I want. I want this pen. It's just a normal, like, Bic pen. It's clear. You can see the blue ink in it. But on the cap, it has the little trident. Yeah. That's all I want.
That they would be so cheap to make.
Right. They don't have to go all out. All they need is to make this. And I was staring at it like, that's all I want. Like, I need to send this to Disney. Like, yeah, this is what we're talking about when we say, like... You don't have to go, like, crazy. It doesn't have to be a click pen that's got all this extra Percy stuff. No. A plain old ballpoint pen. Little trident on the top. That's all I want.
Yeah.
So, yeah. I just... It jumped out at me, and I was like, yeah. I want this!
That jumped out at me, too, because I was like, oh, that's Riptide. Like, that's what, you know, we're meant to imagine when we think of Riptide in the pen form. So, yeah, I thought that was cool. So, some of the illustrations that kind of jumped out, there were a few. I think the Tunnel of Love one really jumped out to me because there were a couple different versions of this, like before they went in the tunnel, then while they were in the tunnel, and it's just, it was very descriptive. It was one of the scenes where we got like multiple viewpoints from it, so it felt very important, and it is.
Yeah.
But how did you feel? Because the little spiders, the little metallic spiders across the bottom of the page actually freaked me out a little when I flipped to it.
Yeah. That, when they take you by surprise, it's like,
They looked cool and I liked the detail, but it definitely, if it was meant to be a little bit of a jump scare, it worked.
Congratulations.
Yeah. The sea spirit who gives Percy the pearls, you remember that scene? I like that scene in the book a lot too, and I think his rendition of that, she was just so beautiful, like, in the water and seeing the pearls and everything. This was just another, I think this was another full scale illustration, and I really liked it a lot. And there's a little bit of a theme with this is when we get into the graphic novel, but I thought that was a really beautiful one too. And then one of the things that I found really interesting about what he did was how he placed certain illustrations on the page. And I always really like, it's like those books that don't follow a normal page format. Like, they might put the words in certain areas on the page and leave a lot of blank space. Or, like, I always go back to Twilight when it's, like, the November, December. Like, it's just the blank page of the month. And you know time is passing, but Abella's, like, gone. Like, she's not really present. That always impacted me a lot. And so you see that a few times with what's going on in the illustrated edition, but Procrustes stretched across the two pages, the bottom of the two pages of his chapter. It was a great illustration. It shows how tall he was. It makes you feel like he's being stretched out. It feels very dynamic in the way that he illustrated that.
Yeah. That's cool. That's cool. I will say one of my, like, favorites, like, kind of the ones that jumped out at me as being really cool, is the visual of Clarice when they're fighting in the Capture the Flag. And, like, this picture of, like, Clarice in full battle armor, she looks like a giant in this illustration. And, I mean, she's bigger than Percy. We know that. But, like, she looks massive compared to tiny little Percy in the foreground. And I just, as much as, like, it feels kind of like a departure because she is also a child, and in this picture she looks like she could be, you know, a million years old or whatever, a giant. I love the visual of it. Like, I love the idea of this kind of being like Percy's view of Clarice.
Yeah.
Like, it's not the actual Clarice standing there. She's not 20 feet tall, but to Percy, she looks like she couldn't be at least 20 feet tall in full armor and this completely terrifying, menacing bad guy that he doesn't know, that he just showed up to camp and is, like, seeing. So that one kind of always jumps out at me as being one of the really fun, like, crazy ones from this book. Because it's not necessarily, like, true to the scale of everything, but it packs such a punch because you just see it and you're like, that's what Percy saw.
Like, oh my gosh. I think that's a really good point, that it's like seeing Clarice from Percy's point of view because he doesn't really know her that well yet. They already did the bathroom scene, so she's already kind of bullied him. And I think her being a child of Ares with the electric spear and with her coming up on him, like, he does see her as 20 feet tall. But you're right, like, she looks like Athena in that moment. She does. Like, she's in battle armor. She looks like an adult. And I think that it was a really cool way to kind of portray that scene.
Yeah.
I also liked seeing, near the end of the book, Zeus and Poseidon on opposite pages because their illustrations are really good and, like, really what I kind of envision when I think of each of them, and you can see how different they are, and it kind of shows them at odds over what to do with Percy, and again, just, like, the placement on the page was as important as the illustration itself.
The one of Poseidon looks so much like Tom Selleck, it's distracting to me, like, I have to say. It just, for some reason, I get his face out of that guy. But I also like them because you get, like, the relaxed Poseidon kind of, he's in, like, a tropical shirt with, like, parrots on it or something. And, like, he's all kind of relaxed, and then you look at Zeus and he's in this full pinstripe suit.
Yeah.
Like, very upright. His chair is so, like, you know, structured and boxy that it's just like, yeah, you can feel the energy change, you know, between them kind of on the page. It's cool.
There were some illustrations that were particularly surprising to me, like the Clarice one. I think maybe the one that was the most surprising was Mr. D, because I literally thought that it was Gabe. Until I was like, wait, who's that blonde standing next to him? Like, that's not Sally. We already saw Sally. It's not Gabe. Then I was like, that's meant to be Mr. D. He does not look anything like the Mr. D that I envision in my mind.
I mean, I think it's hard for me. I don't necessarily have a picture of Mr. D. I really liked Stanley Tucci in the movie. And so I think that's kind of taken over in my brain, like, Stanley Tucci is Mr. D. Like, he is. And I'm really interested to see the new Mr. D, because I think he's going to do a great job.
Yeah.
And it's going to be a very different Mr. D from what was done in the first, in the movies. So, I don't have, like, a non-real life visual of what Mr. D would look like.
Yeah.
So, yeah, this one didn't necessarily, like, shock me, but it wasn't, like, I just didn't know what to make of it, really.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, let's just say, getting confused for Gabe, not a problem.
that's never good.
The one part of this book that's probably my favorite is the underworld, because the pages are black. They're completely black, printed with white lettering, and all of the illustrations have, like, a black background, basically. And again, it's just, like, it's not just what he's drawing, but how he's presenting this artwork on the page. You can tell where you are. You can tell you're in the underworld. It makes it seem different and otherworldly to make the pages all black. Can you imagine if he had to do House of Hades? The entire book would just be printed in black.
Listen, we're printing the whole thing on black paper.
Yeah.
And we're going to start there.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, yeah. Yeah.
And then when you come out of it, the pages switch back to white and, like, you feel that shift. Like, you know you're back to the mortal world. And even just the illustrations themselves in the underworld between Charon, Cerberus, and Hades, they were all very iconic to me. You know, I haven't flipped through this illustrated edition a ton of times.
Right.
But I remember a lot of these. Like, I, in articles and stuff, I use Cerberus and the Charon illustrations quite a lot because they're beautiful and people kind of know what they are and they're very iconic looking. And so I use them a lot. And even Hades, I think, is really well done. So
yeah.
I enjoyed those. And then I think the last little thing for me was Gabe's little statue at the end. It made me laugh. And, yeah, it was pretty funny.
Yeah. Yeah, it's, honest to God, I think the, one of the things that kind of jumped out at me, when you think about the illustrated edition and, like, the graphic novel, I didn't necessarily imagine that the illustrated edition would be as, I don't want to say, like, lifelike, because he does exaggerate things, you know, whatever, but, like, it's not, like, cartoony at all.
Right.
Like, it's all very realistic portrayal. Like, he's trying to match what Rick put on the page, and I don't know if I expected it to be a little less, you know, realistic and a little more, you know, fun or colorful or whatever.
I think part of that might also be that a lot of the official artwork that we got of the characters early on felt very cartoony.
Yeah. And that might be part of why I kind of expected that. So this being more of the John Rocco cover kind of feel to it, rather than more of like a cartoony version, is very cool and kind of startling a little bit. Mm-hmm. Like, some of these illustrations are a little bit scary and they're a little, you know, dark, and you're seeing these monsters for how they were described, not like somebody else's version of them or added this and that. So for that, I will say it's a very well researched and well done interpretation of the of Rick's vision for Percy.
I think for me too, just the amount of illustrations, the fact that it wasn't all just like a full colored page depicting a scene. Sometimes it was just like, yeah, like a random weapon or even the ballpoint pen, just like in the middle of the page. You know, it works so well. It's not something he necessarily had to put in there, but it really lends itself to what's going on and keeps things interesting. And if you do have trouble reading a regular book, I would imagine, you know, that's why people like graphic novels, because there's stuff to look at in addition to all the words. And I feel like this would, you know, work really well for
that. Be a good option. Yeah, for sure.
I love the illustrated edition. I think it's fantastic, and I really, really want more. So maybe one day, hopefully, we'll get that. Next, I want to talk about The Lightning Thief, the graphic novel, which was adapted by Robert Venditti, and we know that he's still adapting them. He's doing, it was the Mark of Athena that he's doing next. And the art is by Attila Futaki, who hasn't, I think maybe did the first two, and then Orpheus Collar took over. Color was by Jose Villarubia, and then the layouts were by Orpheus Collar, which I didn't know, so Orpheus has been involved
since the beginning.
Yeah, since the beginning. And the lettering was by Chris Dickey. And if you know anything about graphic novels and comics and that sort of thing, like, everybody has their own job, and it's always been really interesting to me that, like, the same person who does the art isn't necessarily the same person who colors it.
Yeah.
Isn't necessarily the same person who does the dialogue bubbles and stuff like that. So I think that's really neat.
Yeah, agreed. It's kind of like an animated film in that way. Like, you don't realize all the different people who are doing the backgrounds, the characters, the motion, the people, you know.
Yeah.
Like, there's so many things that go into it and you don't realize it. But yeah, agreed.
Yeah. And this book was published in 2010, so that was 5-ish years after the first book came out. So really not all that long for it to get its own graphic novel. All 5 books in the Percy Jackson and the Olympians series have been made into graphic novels, and I'm pretty sure The Last Olympian was made in, like, did that come out in 2019? I think that was the one that we were surprised that had taken so long for the last one to come out.
That sounds familiar. Yeah,
but they are all officially out now. Yeah. So, overall, what did you think of the graphic novel, just in very, like, general terms?
Well, I looked at the, like, I did my inspection of the illustrated edition first, because I didn't read the whole thing, but I definitely looked through it and looked at a good amount of the pages and stuff. So, I looked at that first, and then I went on to the graphic novel, and it struck me that the art styles are different, but not, like, so different. Like, they're both very realistic, very line-based, and, like, it didn't strike me that they were, like, at odds at all. Like, they are very simpatico kind of thing. Like, it just works.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I think that I kind of expected there to be more of a difference between the two, and I think just the style is not that different. Like, it's definitely different, mm-hmm. but it's not such a huge departure from one to the other.
I mean, I kind of agree. I feel like they're not of different worlds, but at the same time, for me, the illustrated edition is just so much more iconic. That's kind of what I envision. Whereas the graphic novel, some of the panels really took me by surprise, and I didn't always love the artwork, but I don't know if that's just because I do have a very clear idea of these characters in my head, and the graphic novel didn't quite match up with that most of the time.
Yeah.
In some cases it did, in some cases it didn't. We'll talk more about that later, but in terms of just wanting a graphic novel of this book, like, you can't go wrong with it, you know?
Yeah.
It still gets the story across, and it's still very dynamic, and if you like graphic novels, I can't imagine why you wouldn't like this one. However, there are some differences from the Lightning Thief book, and this is according to the fandom website, so I kind of just took this as it was. First of all, there is no reference made about Percy liking blue food.
Which is just...
I just find that...
unexcusable.
Shocking. I will say that at one point, Sally is wearing a very bold blue shirt, and to me, that was, like, maybe the blue reference.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, oh, I wonder if she's going to be in blue for the rest of the book, but she wasn't.
Mm.
She wore red, I think, in the next, like, chapter location or whatever, but yeah, I was like, that's weird that there's no mention of the blue food.
I mean, it's something that you associate with Percy. It's kind
yeah.
of, it's not a personality trait, but it is.
Yeah, I mean, it kind
like,
of is.
It's a fun thing that him and his mom do, and so we kind of, it sticks. It's one of those things, mm-hmm. so that is kind of disappointing.
Yeah, and I mean, it's kind of, it even says more about Sally than it does about Percy, because she did that because Gabe didn't want her to, and it was
yeah.
like her one act of rebellion. And even if they had put blue food in the background, I feel like that would have been enough. But
yeah,
apparently
yeah.
they didn't. But, you know, all things considered, that's not exactly one of the most important things you need to have
no,
in the
not.
Graphic novel anyway. Kyren's lower body, like in the film, is brown. So this is, you know, where, let's see, the film came out in 2010 as well, didn't it?
That sounds right.
So I wonder what came first, you know?
Chicken or the egg.
Yeah. Yeah. Kyren is brown, though, and, you know, I think it looks pretty normal. I think, in general, like, his face and stuff feels very Kyren-like to me.
Yeah.
They also said that Kyren already knows the exact location of the entrance of the underworld from the start. That's probably just a plot thing to, like, keep
yeah.
things moving along.
It probably is an expedience thing, like, having to do frames where he's like, oh, I'm not sure, and then being like, oh, yeah, here it is. Like, it's, like, unnecessary.
Yeah.
So I can see why they cut that.
And I feel like the same thing with the Battle of the Furies on the bus and the bus exploding. It's not shown, but it is kind of, like, in the background, like, they're running away from the bus that sort of looked like it's tipped over or something. That's got to be another expediency thing.
Mm-hmm.
When Ares met Percy, Annabeth, and Grover, he immediately gives the backpack that contains the Master Bolt to Percy and gets them a ride to Las Vegas without asking them to retrieve his shield. So, that's completely out of there, which, that feels like kind of a big chunk to take out. But in terms of the overall plot of this book in particular doesn't seem that important, because that does kind of inform you a little bit more about Hephaestus and Ares and Aphrodite, but that doesn't really come up until a little later in the series.
Yeah, I was gonna say, it probably does more of a disservice to Ares leaving that out, because you're not seeing his first real interaction with Percy, and you're not seeing how they kind of clash from the start, but
yeah. yeah. What I found even more interesting was, apparently, Medusa is not in the printed version of the graphic novel. The scene with her can only be found online. So, obviously, they did it, but they must have cut it from the printed version, I can only assume, to save money.
I mean, maybe. What do you do, then?
I mean, that's... It's kind of weird, and I would assume that maybe they reference it or, you know, something like that, but...
Yeah.
I don't know.
It just seems odd. Like, it's such a defining moment of the beginning of that book, because she's their first monster. She's the first real, like, crazy thing they encounter. I mean, they've got Mrs. Dodds, but they've been dealing with Mrs. Dodds for a while, so to randomly come across Medusa and have to deal with all of that is kind of a defining moment for the three of them, so... To leave that out feels weird.
Yeah. And same thing, like, Procrustes is also not shown, which to me, I feel like in the movie, Procrustes wasn't shown, and that never stood out to me. Like, that was never that big of a deal to me. And I think even here, I can understand that scene kind of slowing the story down a little bit.
Yeah.
Still would have been cool to show. But to not show Cerberus either...
Yeah, that one...
That is shocking to
me. That's a head-scratcher. Because, again, it's kind of like a... It's a very famous part of the underworld and, like, all of that. Like, coming across Cerberus in the underworld is, like, you know, bread and butter. You do that. That's what happens.
Mm-hmm.
So to, like, just leave it out feels odd.
Yeah. Percy also didn't fight Luke in the end. Chiron just explains that he ran away without telling anybody, which that doesn't really sit well with me.
Some of these, I question, like, why you wouldn't want to show that in... the cells. Like, why wouldn't you want to give us this depiction of Percy and Luke fighting? Like, that feels like a great idea for a graphic novel cell.
Right.
So, like, what was the... I would love to hear, like, the explanation for why some of this stuff was left.
Yeah. Robert, can we talk to you?
Give us some input. I want
to
know.
I mean, I have to say, like, we're being a little critical of it because we're obviously huge fans of the story. But that being said, I know how difficult it is to adapt a book into a movie, so
right.
It makes sense that adapting it into a graphic novel would be difficult as well. And I really wonder how much of that actually comes from the publishing house, like the publisher saying, okay, you can only have 138 pages,
right.
And, you know, Medusa was brought it up to 139, so they cut Medusa out of that or something like that.
Yeah.
There's got to be parameters and restrictions that they have to abide by.
It's probably very true.
Yeah. And one of the superficial things is just that Luke's scar is on the opposite side of his face, apparently. And I could see that just being like, well, we want him specifically in this pose, but we got to make sure people know he has a scar, so let's just put it on that side.
Yeah.
Or something. Or maybe it was a mistake.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Also possible.
That one's not as big of a deal, though.
Yeah.
I also had some random observations for the graphic novel. The first being, and this is, I guess, where we want to get into the artwork style a little bit, is that Percy looks so much older in this than the illustrated edition, and it really, all the characters do, and it really kind of took me off guard.
I think, yeah, I agree with you there. That's probably one of the more defining differences between the two, is that... In the graphic... And maybe it's because of the nature of a graphic novel where they just... They're adapting it so they make them look older because in a graphic novel you're literally seeing the violence as opposed to, like... Even in an illustrated edition, like, you can kind of hide it. It's an illustration of a scene, so you can kind of give them an action pose without it being a violent pose.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas you're... In a graphic novel, you're watching the story cell by cell... And it's, you don't have those large paragraphs of text to kind of give you the visual. You are trying to visualize the entire battle scene or whatever. So I can kind of see why they would age them up a little, just to kind of let it feel a little less terrifying, scary.
Yeah, that's a fair point.
Yeah.
Yeah. I will say, though, that this is much closer to the Mr. D I picture in my head with his little leopard print shirt and just his whole style. I feel like this is Mr. D. I don't trust the other Mr. D. Sorry, John Rocco. And at one point, like, to me, the artwork in the graphic novel isn't really my style. You know, obviously that's not saying it's bad because, like, I could do better. But it wasn't really my style. But... Luke covered in rainbows during the iris message at the car wash. I thought he was so pretty. I really liked that. And I didn't really like Ares's look either. I feel like he just seemed very different from what I imagined in my head. You don't get to see his motorcycle seat. I don't know why I want to see human skin so badly, but...
It's because it's such a powerful idea.
Yeah.
Of, like, his seat being made of human skin. Like, it's, ugh, it's so gross. You want to see it just so that you have, like... Yeah, it's weird. So I get it. I get it.
Yeah. And I will say... One thing I liked about the graphic novel is we get to see way more of the Lotus Hotel, and we didn't really get to see much of that in the illustrated edition. I think it was only the outside part of it, but here we actually get to see them interacting with people and, you know, playing games and that sort of thing.
Which would make sense, because they do spend, I mean, it's like an hour or two in, like, real, like, in the... actual book, like, mm-hmm. it feels like only a couple hours have passed, but it's actually been days, so, like,
right.
I can kind of see why it would take more of a presence in the graphic novel than the illustrated.
Yeah. And unfortunately, in the graphic novel, the underworld panels, they're cool, but they're way more effective in the illustrated edition because you get that black background.
Yeah.
And I feel like they really should have pulled from the illustrated... Well, I guess the illustrated edition came after, so never mind to that. But I really thought that it would have been super cool if those had also been fully black instead of having some of the white behind it.
Mm.
And not a super fan of Hades' look. I kind of liked him better in the illustrated edition. And the thrones on Olympus aren't individualized. They were just all the same kind of throne. It wasn't like, you know, Poseidon's little swivel chair on the boat and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So I really hope the show makes them individual.
I mean, after the chapter we're about to read, like, I feel like they kind of have to be different.
Yeah.
It's like, it would be weird for them all to be just standard thrones. Like, they each have their own personality, and it kind of is reflected in how their throne takes its appearance. So... Hopefully, yeah, that's something that they adjust for the show.
Yeah. I mean, I could see them not doing it simply to save money, but at this point, you might as well just do it.
I mean, yeah. I agree.
And this one is maybe a little out of left field, but Grover is shockingly hot in the final few pages. And, like I said, all of them look a lot more grown up. And he's, like, got his shirt off, and he's, like... not ripped, but he's definitely got muscles and abs, and he's a very lean, but, like, he's very attractive at the end, and, like, I don't have a problem finding Grover attractive, but it was just...
It took you aback.
Yeah, because I picture Grover as a little chunky, a little, like, sloppy almost, and just, you know, like a kid.
Yeah.
And this was not... that.
It was a little different.
Yeah. Some of my favorite panels are the pen is mightier than the sword scene. That was really good. The dynamic of him throwing the pen and Percy catching it and it turning into the sword, that really lends itself to the graphic novel, so I thought they did a great job there. Again, the Pearl Sea Spirit Lady, also a beautiful scene. I really loved that in both of the books. They did them differently, but they both did them very well. And then the Lotus Hotel was definitely a favorite. Urban Planner Extreme and Polluter Shooter.
I feel like all three of those are kind of... they're moments that lend themselves to being, like, pretty or prettified, as opposed to, like, the battle sequences and the monsters and some of the gods, and, like, you can't make Ares pretty. And,
you know, really can't.
Like, so I feel like... I like that they took the opportunity to make some of these moments where you have a chance to make something just really beautiful, beautiful.
Yeah.
Like, that... I like that they took advantage of that.
Definitely. So, you know, overall, that's the illustrated edition, the graphic novel. I think I definitely prefer the illustrated edition, but there are things you can do in the graphic novel that you can't really do in the illustrated edition. And I would be very curious to, you know, this is the only one I own, so I definitely need to get some of the other ones, and I'd really like to see how it might evolve over the course of the 5 graphic novels and just see kind of where we end up, and then into Heroes of Olympus to see if there's a stark change in the imagery or the style or anything. I think that would be pretty cool. But yeah.
And you said they change artists.
Yes, yeah, because Orpheus Collar ends up doing the art for them, I think, after the second one, but don't quote me on that.
So I'd be interested to see if it changes a little.
Yeah.
If the kids look different or something like that, yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely worth checking out.
Mm-hmm.
And that brings us to The Last Olympian, in which we will be talking about chapter 19. And if there was a big chapter...
Yeah, this is the biggest one.
This is my longest summary yet, so if you normally, you know, need to get a drink of water or a snack or something, now is the time to do it.
Yes.
Because it's going to take me a minute to get through all of this. There's just so much, and again, it's like the last chapter where some of it's unspoken stuff, or it's stuff that's really hard to summarize, like the whole, we'll get there, the whole thing with, like, Luke and Kronos at the end, like, it's really hard to get that into a few words, mm-hmm. So I did my very best, but it's still quite lengthy.
It is quite long, but if you're going to do it with any chapter, it might as well be this one. It is literally the climax of the story.
Yeah. So here we go. As our heroes reach Olympus, the walkway is collapsing before their eyes. They jump for the stones and move quickly to the city before they, you know, plummet to their deaths. They make it to the mountain just as the last stone falls, leaving the elevator lingering unmoored quite a distance away. Our heroes are officially on their own. Evidence of Kronos' scythe is rampant around the city. They walk through and they can see slashes and things burning and falling and all of that. You can also see evidence that Kronos has slayed minor gods and nature spirits along the way as, you know, they walk down this walkway and they can see items of clothing or things that were left behind by all of these creatures and gods and things. Then they hear the booming voice of Kronos screaming, "Brick by brick! That was my promise! Tear it down! Brick by brick!" Suddenly, a gold dome shoots into the sky as a temple explodes. Talia tells them that was a shrine to Artemis he just destroyed. She's gonna make him pay. Just then, a marble archway collapses, sending statues of Zeus and Hera plummeting to the ground. The Hera statue would have crushed Percy and Annabeth, but Talia dives forward and saves them, leaving her with her legs pinned under the statue in the process. They leave her, reluctantly, and keep moving forward toward Kronos and the other temples he's exploded along the way. In fact, they run. They climb a pile of rubble and eventually can see the throne room. Kronos is standing in the middle, debating which throne to destroy first. No sign of Rachel or Hestia, but Bessie is still floating in her water globe in the corner, trying not to make any noise at all. Our three heroes step into the light, and Ethan spots them. He alerts Kronos, who smiles at Percy. Percy mentions that Luke would fight with a sword, so Kronos produces Backbiter, making Annabeth gasp as she remembers the line of the prophecy, "A hero's soul, cursed blade, shall reap." Percy and Kronos begin fighting, while Annabeth squares up against Ethan, protecting Percy's back. Grover plays his reed pipes. Percy jumps backwards onto Hephaestus' throne, and it starts defense mode. Percy avoids the threads of electricity that shoot out of the throne, but they get Kronos. Lucronos drops to his knees and lets Backbiter go. Annabeth takes the opportunity to charge him, calling for Luke as she went. Kronos flicks his hand, and Annabeth flies backwards into an Athena statue. Kronos is weakened, and his sword won't come to his hand freely anymore. His magic just doesn't have the same pull. Kronos then calls for Ethan to prove himself by killing Percy, since he knows about Percy's secret weakness. Percy asks Ethan if he's ready to see everything destroyed. Ethan is mad that his mother Nemesis gets no respect, and not a throne. Percy reasons with him. The minor gods deserve better, Ethan, but total destruction isn't balance. Kronos doesn't build, he only destroys. Then, Ethan charges. Kronos! He brings his sword down on the Titan Lord's neck, but his blade shatters, embedding itself in Ethan's stomach instead. Grover has been growing grass in the throne room to try and protect Annabeth, and he tries to do the same for Ethan, but Kronos shatters the floor under him and he falls into open air and disappears. Kronos then backs Percy up to Poseidon's throne. Percy and Lucronos fight with swords. Kronos pulls Percy's attention to the hearth, and he shows our demigod hero visions of everything going on. Nico and the dead being overrun but still fighting downstairs, the gods being tossed around by a terrifying Typhon, and Percy gets a good look at just how Typhon looks. Percy is stuck in Kronos' time spell, but he can feel it slowly loosening. Just as Typhon steps into the Hudson River, Poseidon arrives, along with a legion of Cyclopes, led by Typhon. Once Typhon is mired down by the chains that they're wrapping around his legs, Poseidon throws his trident through Typhon's throat, spilling golden ichor all over. The other gods then renew their attack, and he weakens with every hit. Poseidon opens a tunnel through the ocean straight to Tartarus, and Typhon sinks out of sight until he's gone. Kronos advances on Percy and throws Grover aside as he moves. Percy attacks, but Lucronos knows the move and disarms Percy, sending Riptide into an open fissure in the floor. Just then, Annabeth screams for them to stop. She steps up to Lucronos, holding his weapon back with only her knife hilt. She talks straight to Luke, trying to bring his mind to the forefront. She believes that the prophecy applies to Luke and that his mother believed it as well. His mother saw his end, and that's why she was so affected by it. Kronos knocks her backward, but neither Percy nor Grover can get to Annabeth in time. Laying on the ground, looking up into Luke Kronos's face, she calls Luke to keep his promise. Just then, Luke's consciousness seems to push forward. Annabeth is begging Percy to give her her knife as she can't reach it. He approaches Lucronos, and Luke tries to tell Percy what needs to happen, but only seems to get out bits and pieces as he's trying to keep control. Then Percy remembers Rachel's words, "You are not the hero." Percy realizes that Luke must be the one to kill Kronos by killing his own body before Kronos can reach his ultimate form. Percy hands Luke the knife. Luke stabs himself just under his left arm. He then howls, his eyes glow like lava, the room shakes, and then an aura of energy begins to form around him. Percy shuts his eyes. When he opens them again, Luke is laying at the hearth, ash surrounding him. Kronos' scythe is melted and is trickling into the hearth. As Luke is dying, Annabeth reassures him he was a hero in the end and that he'll go to Elysium. He tells Annabeth he'll probably try for Isle of the Blessed. Luke begs Percy also not to let the children of the minor gods or the unclaimed remain disrespected just like him. Percy promises to do right by them, and then Luke dies. The gods burst in moments later, expecting a battle, but not finding one. Percy announces that they need a shroud for the son of Hermes.
That was a monster.
It's so big. There's so much going on.
Yeah. But, I mean, this whole book, this whole series has literally led to this moment.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. It's worthy of being the longest and most involved chapter. Yeah. And I don't know that for certain because we still have a few more to go. But yeah. I'm pretty sure this is probably the longest.
I would bet money. If not the longest, then it's definitely top three.
Yeah. Okay, so when we start this chapter, they've arrived at the top of the elevator. They're looking out at Olympus, and the walkway is slowly dissolving. We know that it's like a floating walkway that gets you to Olympus that they've walked on before. And so they have to hurry, they jump, they leap. But I just think that the idea of like the walkway dissolving, Olympus kind of losing its connection to the real world, that being, like, the first thing that confronts them, it just shows how much effect Kronos has just being in Olympus.
Yeah.
Like, he hasn't really even touched the gods yet or their thrones. He's just there, and it's affecting Olympus's ties to the world.
Yeah. And this whole opening scene is very cinematic. Like, Rick's writing is often very cinematic, but there's something about several of the scenes, several of the moments in this book in particular that I can see it. And I can see it in the way that the television show could do it. And I'm very much looking forward to watching this at some point.
Absolutely. The other visual that really sticks out at me is that elevator, like, completely unattached to Olympus at all, just kind of like not floating, but like I feel like it's like balancing and like maybe teetering a little as it's just holding on to the only connection that's there, and it's not connected to Olympus anymore. So it's just kind of,
it's funny because I specifically remember seeing in the illustrated edition his rendition of what the elevator looks like and how it looked like a beam of light well above the Empire State Building with Olympus like a floating island above it. And I was thinking of that moment as I was reading this chapter.
Yeah, I can imagine that. Yeah, that would help. They are making their way through the city and they're seeing just evidence that Kronos is there and he's been slashing stuff as he goes. And that gets them to this archway that is like, it's got Hera on one side and Zeus on the other. And it crumbles as they walk under it, and it traps Talia, And the whole thing, like, first of all, it's like, why does this archway crumble now? Like, way to go, Rick. Like, way to put this in there. But it actually has roots in the rest of the story, in what's happened prior to this, mm-hmm. in this book. Annabeth totally blames Hera. She apologizes to Talia for kind of letting this happen, or, you know, that it happened. Because Hera is still really pissed at Annabeth, and so she's taking it out on Annabeth by trying to kill her with this archway.
Yeah.
Even as Annabeth is trying to save Olympus, Hera is still...
Yeah.
Like, come on! She's trying to save your butt, and you're literally making it more difficult.
You can't lift the curse for, like, 2 seconds.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think on the one side, I thought this was brilliant, because it's very full circle. It gives you a reason as to why Talia is not with them. And so, again, it's just the trio. And in the end, it's just basically Annabeth and Percy going up against Lou Kronos and, you know, how important that specific moment is. So it takes Talia out of the running, which needed to happen. And for this to have, like, it not be like an accident, but like a logical reason, I think was very smart writing to like plant that in the beginning. However, on the other side of that, I totally forgot this was a thing until Annabeth mentioned it again.
Yeah.
And I don't think it had been mentioned since the opening chapters. So I think it would have been nice to have that sprinkled a little bit more throughout the book, but
yeah.
You know, I can let something like that go. That's not a big thing in the whole, like, scheme of things.
Yeah, we also had that whole pocket of time where we didn't really see Annabeth, too. Like, yeah. We're kind of separated from her, so that probably made it difficult, too, to kind of weave it in there better.
That's fair.
Yeah. Okay, so that brings us to Percy, Annabeth, and Grover climbing over the rubble into the throne room. And as they are, like, stepping into the light, Kronos sees them. Ethan tells Kronos that, you know, that they're there. And Kronos sees them, and he just smiles. And Annabeth kind of, like, has a moment. Like, she's looking at Luke smiling at her and Percy, and, like, It's sinister, because Kronos is smiling at Percy, like, oh, he's here to die. Great, fabulous. But, like, you can tell Annabeth is thinking, like, back to times when Luke smiled at her, and it's like, that has to be so creepy.
Yeah. It's very much like Stiles and the Negitsune.
Yeah.
Like, this is Stiles, but it's not Stiles. There's something else in there. And, like, when you know a person that well, and you know that they've turned, it just makes it worse. It's like a monster staring out through your friend's face.
Yeah.
And there's just, I feel like there's nothing that can compare to how creepy that is.
Yeah. No, absolutely. And so she just kind of winces in the moment, and it kind of just sticks out at you, because you're like, oh, you kind of put yourself in Annabeth's shoes for a moment. And you're like, oh, that had to have been.
As much of a betrayal as this has been for Percy, it's way worse for Annabeth.
Absolutely. Like, 100%. Basically, after that, it's time to fight, which means that there's a whole bunch of stuff that happens, like, simultaneously, it's weird. Okay, so they're basically just sword fighting for the first bit, because Percy, you know, says that Luke would fight with a sword, so Kronos is using Backbiter still, I believe, because he has his scythe, but he's using Backbiter to fight.
I thought the scythe turned into Backbiter.
Did it? Oh, yeah, see, I didn't catch that.
Because the scythe is Backbiter. Remember, it was like he transformed it into...
Okay.
Yeah.
That makes more sense, because I thought he just, like, tossed his scythe aside and pulled Backbiter out of his pocket. But you're totally right. Okay, so he turns it into the sword. Anyway, so they're sword fighting, and they're hopping all around the place, and Grover is playing his reed pipes, trying to be helpful, but he can't really, like, fight.
Your description in the recap was really funny. It's like, Grover's growing grass, trying to help them.
Yeah.
And I'm like, that's not wrong. It's a factual statement.
It's what he did, but it doesn't make a whole lot of sense, and you're like, wait, what? But
throughout the chapter, Percy does say that, like, the music kind of calms him, and, like, it even affects Ethan at one point, mm-hmm. and I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah, I liked that they found a way to work Grover into the fight without having Grover, like, armed and fighting,
because it's not his thing. That's not what he does,
Especially these days, with how focused he is on nature and helping nature. Like, he's not a fighter.
Yeah.
He's a lover, not a fighter. okay, so they're fighting, and Percy leaps backwards onto Hephaestus' throne, and it turns defense mode, and, like, kicks up, and Percy has no idea what's about to happen, but he happens to get out of the way at the right moment, and the throne throws out, like, electric shocks that catch Kronos, and it kind of knocks him to the side, in which, that moment, Annabeth takes that second of Kronos being, like, slightly thrown off to try and get Luke's attention. Like, I think she even calls for Luke as opposed to, like, Kronos. And as she does that, Kronos kind of comes back to his mind, and he flings her aside without even touching her. So she's knocked out, and Grover uses this grass. He's, like, growing it to kind of, like, shield her, I think. But also, he's making his way closer to her as he does this. So I think he's also using it as kind of, like, a distraction. Like, he's got all this grass growing in the middle of the throne room, and, you know, hopefully they won't see him sneaking ambrosia to her.
Do you think Aryan is going to take reed pipe lessons?
I mean, he kind of has to.
Yeah, right?
I guess he can pretend, but
it'd be cool if he actually
played it. Right? It would be so cool if he could play the reed pipes by the time you get to the end.
Yeah.
That would be so cool. Kronos then calls for Ethan to kill Percy. And this is the moment. Like, they've been building to this. Their whole relationship, yeah. Ethan and Percy, Percy has spared him numerous times. And this is the time. Ethan knows where Percy's weakness is, which...
This is what I was talking about last time. I realized he's in the vanguard because he's the one person who knows where Percy's Achilles heel is. That makes total sense.
Yeah, and, like, he could tell Kronos, but then Kronos would have no reason to keep him alive. So I'm sure Ethan has kind of kept it close to the vest.
It makes sense to bring somebody else with you as a distraction. Yeah. You know, he can attack Percy while Kronos recovers or whatever. So,
absolutely. Yeah. This whole thing kind of is the head of their entire relationship so far. And Percy reasons with Ethan and convinces him that Nemesis is about balance. It's what you've been saying all along. And Kronos is not balance. He wants what he wants. He has no interest in finding balance. And Ethan surprises him by, like, you don't even really get, like, a scene, any moment where his face changes or something. He just turns and attacks Kronos.
Yeah, this part, like, look, I really liked this because Percy's argument is solid. It is a great argument. And there was a clear path all the way from Battle of the Labyrinth laid out in front of us for this moment. Like, all of that led to here. All of the interactions with Ethan led here. But I kind of wish that we could have taken a little bit more time to see Ethan struggle and then, like, harden his resolve and then do what he did.
Yeah.
But I also understand that in this chapter where so much is going on, maybe we didn't have the time to, like, go through everything with Ethan. You know, you have to keep things moving.
Yeah. After Ethan turns on Kronos, he's injured by his own knife because he tries to stab him and it shatters.
Yeah, his sword, I think it was.
Yeah.
And it breaks, and then I thought that was, like, kind of crazy that it, you know, hurt himself.
It rebounds and gets him in the stomach. And then he, like, falls to the ground, and as Grover's trying to, like, grow the grass to do exactly what he's doing for Annabeth, which... I mean, he doesn't know Ethan, but he's still willing. He's a demigod. He's willing to try. Kronos shatters the ground next to him, and he falls.
Yeah. I think Ethan could have survived that if it wasn't for Kronos. With some nectar and ambrosia, he probably could have survived that wound. But Kronos... Ethan's a traitor now. Kronos isn't going to let him live, and he sends him to his death. I get why people like Ethan Nakamura so much. You know, we were really surprised when I did a poll at one point. I think it was for the standalone books that we were most interested in seeing. And Nico won, of course.
Yeah.
Second was Ethan Nakamura. And I was shocked by that. I was like, I mean, I remember him, but I didn't remember too much about him. I didn't realize people loved him so much. But I kind of get it. He is very intelligent. Mm-hmm. He's a very intelligent demigod. He's strangely charismatic. Like, I kind of like him.
Mm-hmm.
He's tough. He's ultimately a hero in the end. People love a redemption story, and that works really well here for Ethan. And I couldn't imagine a world where he's still alive. We didn't see him die.
Right. No, it's true.
Something could have happened. Ethan could still be out there somehow. if Rick ever wanted to write a random standalone novel, especially one about redemption and balance and this idea of revenge not necessarily being like an evil thing, but of a balanced thing, I would read a book about Ethan Nakamura.
Well, yeah, I could see a future in which, like, somehow Ethan survives the fall because he doesn't fall, you know, into the city. He falls into a cloud, or I don't know. Like,
there's, or somebody saves him.
Right, like, something swoops and saves him from the, yeah, something. I could see him surviving the fall. And if he survives the fall, he doesn't, like, belong at camp. He's not from camp, so he doesn't care about camp. So he goes on and makes his life about balance. Like, mm-hmm. he really, you know, I could see an entire story about Ethan trying to balance the sides, keep things from getting out of balance entirely. Yeah. Like, I could totally read that story.
And that's like an anti-hero kind of story. Somebody who isn't good or bad, but yeah. just works toward the balance. That could be fascinating.
Yeah. Like, he meets a bad guy and he, you know, stops him from taking over whatever, and then he comes across some good hero guy who's trying to do something that's going to throw everything out of balance, and he fights, works against him too. Yeah. Like, you could kind of have both sides of the coin, which would be really cool.
Yeah.
But anyways, that's where we say goodbye to Ethan for now. We'll see if Rick ever decides to revisit him. That would be interesting. But no, Kronos and Percy continue fighting after Ethan is gone. And at one point, they get really close to the hearth. And Kronos starts showing Percy visions of everything going on downstairs. So they're not really fighting as much at this moment. But Percy is looking at all of the battle going on downstairs. He's seeing Nico and this army of the dead trying to defeat the monsters, but they're almost like equally matched. It's just, they're not overwhelming either on either side. His mom is still down there fighting, and he's, you know, obviously worried because there's only so long that Sally and Paul can hold their own.
Yeah.
And then he sees the gods fighting Typhon, and it's terrifying, and Typhon is scarier than anything. He's never going to forget that visual, is what he says.
Yeah, he literally says that. And this is not how I envisioned Typhon.
No.
Like, I envisioned him as the, like, half the cyclone creature, half the mountain creature from Disney's Hercules. Okay. Like, the titans that go across to Mount Olympus. Like, I kind of envisioned him like this. But he's, like, reptilian, and his head keeps changing shape, and he never really
different
stays,
monsters.
Like,
yeah.
one thing. And it's just, it's weird, and that's going to be really interesting to see how they try to bring that to the small screen.
For some reason, and I do not know why, I pictured Typhon as, like, a human, like a big, like, almost looks human kind of titan. Like, I don't know why, that there's no grounds for me envisioning him that way. But, like, for some reason, I just pictured him like this big Grecian warrior.
Okay.
Kind of that his, his aura was just so dark that it becomes this, like, storm that, as he marches across. So, like, yeah, this was a bit of a departure from how I've been picturing Typhon this whole time, too. But, you know, it is what it is. So he sees this, and as he's watching the gods, like, being defeated by Typhon, he's watching them all kind of fall and keep fighting, but keep falling. And he secretly is like, you know, in his head, he's like, come on, Dad. Like, right now. Now's the time. And Typhon steps into the Hudson River. And all of a sudden, here comes Poseidon. And he's here to save the day. And who is leading the Legion of Cyclopes with a bunch of chains but Tyson?
I got goosebumps reading this.
I did, too.
And it made me very emotional. It's that moment in the middle of the battle when the tides have turned, quite literally, and you just can't help but cheer. Like, it's so exciting, and again, everything is so cinematic, and, you know, between this moment and the Nico moment, like, it's just, ooh, it fills me with so much excitement and vigor. I love it so much.
It's so true.
Gets me pumped.
It is. It's amazing. So the Cyclopes are wrapping these chains around Typhon, and as they do that, Poseidon takes his trident and throws it through Typhon's throat.
Yeah.
And it just starts spilling this ichor out into the water, and it's just, so once you see that, you know, like, okay, that the tides really have turned. Yeah. Like, this is going to, he's going to go down here, and then the gods will be free to help protect Olympus, and that's where all of this is going to change.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So you see that happen, and then the other gods get kind of reinvigorated, and they start fighting, and they're able to send Typhon back to Tartarus.
Yeah.
He opened
through a secret tunnel.
It's a secret Poseidon tunnel that he has. He can just open it anywhere to Tartarus, and shoom, there he is. And he's gone.
Down the laundry chute.
Yeah, pretty much. Pretty much. And, of course, Cronus, like, screams no in the throne room and is so angry to see. But he, you know, he's insistent that Typhon was just a part of his plan. Like, this is not... Just because Typhon fell doesn't mean that he's going to fail.
It's not over yet.
Right. So he continues to fight, and Grover jumps up to try and protect Percy from an attack, and he is thrown back, much like Annabeth was. Which Percy, in that moment, is not the one to take up the attack. Annabeth is actually the one who gets the next hit, I guess. She comes charging forward, and with her little knife, holds Backbiter at bay.
Yeah.
And Percy almost can't believe it's happening. Like, he's like, only a really, really skilled knife fighter could have managed this. And she does it, like, instant. Like, she just does it.
Yeah.
And it's first of all, it's just impressive.
Yeah. Like,
I just love seeing Annabeth the Warrior really come out of her.
Yeah.
We don't get to see it all that often.
And I'm so glad she gets so many moments in these last couple of chapters, because she has been gone for so long. Like, the spotlight is really on her in this chapter in a lot of different ways, and I'm so happy to see it.
Yeah. So she is holding Backbiter at bay, and she is talking directly into Lucronos' face, trying to get Luke to come forward. Like, she's talking directly to Luke, ignoring Cronus when he responds, and she's saying, like, remember the promise, remember the family, like, remember what promise we made. And in that moment, like, that's when Luke kind of takes control back.
Mm-hmm. And he throws Backbiter, right? He throws Backbiter into the hearth. And a little bit later, when Cronus goes to pick it up, he burns himself. And I just gotta say, Hestia is really the only god that has harmed Cronus this entire time. And that feels so significant. The fact that the last Olympian is Hestia. That's the name of the book. She's the only one that hurt him. And family is pivotal to this whole moment where Cronus gets defeated and the hearth and all of these people together. And I was just like, oh, like, I know Rick is smart, but, like, this moment just... this is not something that I would have understood when I read it when I was younger. But now, now I'm like... this is huge. This is so awesome.
Yeah, it is. And it's not something he, like, highlights. He doesn't say, like, Hestia burns Cronus. Like, no. Luke chucks the sword lands in the hearth, and she, like, you know, the hearth had been dwindling, and as this fight goes on, it gets more and more, you know, it warms up, and you see those coals kind of catch fire again. And so, yeah, it, like, heats the sword so much that she's able to hurt him, which is cool. Yeah, no. It's a really good point. It's a really good point. Okay, so Annabeth kind of puts all the pieces together, I think, in this last moment. I don't think this is something she had previously kind of worked out, but she's thinking about the prophecy, and she's thinking about the line that I read earlier that I can't think of at this exact moment. The one about the cursed blade shall reap a hero's soul.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think a hero's soul,
a cursed blade shall reap. It's the opposite.
I think it was, she realized it the moment he took out Backbiter, I think.
Yeah, like she gasped because she's like, that's what's going on. And she kind of has put together that his mother saw his end and saw what was going to happen. And that's what kind of addled her. That's what threw her so, you know, why she was so affected by everything else. And Annabeth is, you know, it seems like Luke kind of figures it out at the same time Annabeth, or very shortly after Annabeth does. And so the two of them are trying to convince Percy to hand him the knife.
Yeah.
That Annabeth has lost because her arm was hurt or something. Right. Because she can't really reach it herself. And she's like, you know, Percy, you just need to give him the knife because Luke is the only one who has the ability to injure Cronus because he is Cronus. If you try and do it, Kronos will come to the forefront and defend himself, Luke has to be the one.
Right.
And it's such a crazy moment.
This is, again, so brilliant. What a good twist.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes back to what Rachel said to Percy, you are not the hero.
Yeah.
Because Luke is technically the hero who will get reaped by the blade.
Yep.
And just the fact that Luke had to be the one to do it himself is just an amazing twist. It's so good. It's not something you can really see coming.
Mm-mm.
And I really loved it. But I think what was most interesting and what caused a few questions in my mind was the fact that the knife is the cursed blade.
Yes.
And it's the cursed blade because Luke broke his promise to always be family with Annabeth.
Mm-hmm.
This, to me, wasn't, like, super clear.
Yeah.
Because up until this point, we never, like, got an idea that the knife was cursed in any way. Like, right. I understand that it's basically cursed for Luke.
Yeah.
Because he made the promise on the blade when he gave it to her, but I think it's very well done. I like that the knife was the cursed blade and not the sword or Riptide or anything like that, like Backbiter or Riptide. But I wish, I don't know, there was more of a progression into that thought.
Yeah. Like, if, rather than leading us toward Backbiter being the cursed blade or giving us the impression that maybe Riptide is a cursed blade, like, we don't know that, but it could be, I wish they had included the knife as a possibility.
Mm-hmm.
Not that we need to be directed to the knife or anything, that we need to keep track of it. But, like, even if Annabeth said something like, you know, under her breath about the promise that Luke made, or, you know, just something to kind of lead us to the knife being a possible blade that could end up in this spot. Or maybe even that Annabeth was afraid that she could be the one that the blade took, and maybe that would lead us to the knife, you know, something that would have maybe given us a little bit more to think about. Yeah, I agree with you there. So Luke stabs himself with the knife in his weak spot, which is under his left arm, I believe, and it's like in a spot that would be really hard to hit mm-hmm. with armor on. And in that moment, he howls, and then his eyes turn almost like lava. They like glow, they start to glow, and then his aura just starts, like, pulsing because clearly Kronos is about to, like, explode out of him.
Yeah.
And I love that Percy just kind of, like, sees that happen, closes his eyes. I'm sure he's, like, over Annabeth, like, trying to keep her eyes closed. And then the next thing he sees, like, when he opens his eyes again, is Luke right by the hearth with, like, this circle of ash around him from that explosion from mm-hmm. Kronos. And it's just a really powerful visual.
Yeah, the thing that struck me was also it was Luke's blue eyes that Percy really notices at first, too.
Yeah, which is also, pretty significant. Also funny with Selena's blue eyes being the signifier that, like, she wasn't Clarice. Like, he sees her eyes. And here, like, Luke, seeing Luke's eyes is the signifier that, like, Kronos is really gone.
That's true, yeah.
That's kind of crazy.
So, before we get into, like, the heavier stuff, I just want to mention really quickly, you know, as Luke is dying, he basically asks Annabeth if she loved him. And I get that this needed to be resolved for, like, Percy's sake, because he spent so long wondering if Annabeth loves Luke, if she cares about him more than she cares about Percy. And it's been, like, literally the point of contention for them pretty much this entire book. And he needed to know the answer to that, and that's why this was written in here. But, like, I also want to remind everyone that Luke is 22 years old, and Annabeth is 16, and there has been a large age difference between the two of them the entire time. And I do just find it kind of weird. Like, I understand from Annabeth's point of view, if she had had a crush on Luke, that's very normal to me because you tend to crush on, you know, somebody you look up to, older guys, you know, like, that makes sense. But, like, for Luke to ask that was, like, I don't know, it felt weird to me.
I also think it feels weird, but I think it feels weird for the opposite reason.
Really?
I think it's weird that he didn't know that she loved him.
Oh.
Not necessarily romantically, but, like, she loved Luke.
Yeah.
There was never a question in my mind. And I think Percy questioned how much she loved Luke, whether it was a romantic kind of love or, like, a brotherly love, which she does mention.
Yeah.
But, like, she clearly loves him. And I was really confused in this moment why she would say she doesn't love him, because that's totally not true. Mm-hmm. Like, he was her family. He was her brother. Yes, she had some confusing feelings that she wasn't sure what they were. He's not her actual brother.
Right.
But, like, you know, I could see why I could see that he asked in that moment because he wanted to be reassured that, like, she cared for him. But, like, I was more confused why Annabeth said no. Because that's totally not true. You don't have to be in love with someone to love them. And that bothered me.
She understood what he meant by that versus, but I agree. Like, she definitely loved him.
Yeah.
It just was a brotherly love. I think that this scene would have actually been better if he was trying to use it, like, if Kronos was trying to use it to manipulate her, being like, oh, you love me. How could you do this to me? And her be like, I love you like a brother. Like, that's not going to stop me. It doesn't change anything. It would still tell Percy how Annabeth truly feels without it being this, like, kind of creepy factor here at the end. As, like, Luke's last thing, one of the last things he talks about other than the gods is whether or not Annabeth loved him. It seemed weird to me.
Well, and yeah, it for me, and then her saying no, it was like, ow.
Yeah.
like, way to stab a guy when he's down there, Annabeth. Like, I get why she's being honest. She's telling him, I do not have romantic feelings for you. Mm-hmm. I get it. And again, Percy needed to hear that too.
Yeah, that was more for Percy than anything
else. But I do think there might have been a better way to get this whole thing, the whole idea across without having it be kind of awkward. Yeah. Yeah. No, I agree. That all happens with Luke as they're laying there with him, and Annabeth is in, you know, she's insisting that he was a hero in the end, that he's clearly going to Elysium, and he mentions, like, oh, I might try again for Isle of the Blessed, and she's like, you're always a perfectionist, like, you know, you gotta overachiever much.
Yeah, I'm surprised he was potentially gonna get into Elysium to begin with, considering all the bad stuff he did. Like, I know he made the ultimate sacrifice, but, like, at the same time, you're the reason why we're here to begin with.
Right? Like, does this outweigh all the things that got us to this point?
Yeah.
And, I mean, he is still young, and he was, you know, like, kind of manipulated into being on Kronos' side. So, it's hard. It's hard to kind of draw that line.
Yeah.
But, yeah, definitely an interesting moment there. And then we get Luke's request of Percy. He kind of looks him in the eye and says, what happened to me? What happened to Ethan? What happened to, you know, do not let the minor gods and the unclaimed children continue to be disrespected the way we have been. And Percy promises that he will not let this continue, that he's going to do something. And that is basically the end. Luke dies. We see him die on camera, on screen.
Yeah.
Quote unquote screen. And then the gods arrive and they find Luke dead, and they kind of ask what happened, and Percy says, we need a shroud for the son of Hermes. And
yeah, which, I mean, is very, it feels very, like, Selena-esque, too. Like, you know, he died a hero, even though he did bad things. Like, we still need to respect the sacrifice that both of them made.
Yeah.
So, I really appreciated that. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, I mean, I'm so glad that we have more chapters, because if we were ending in the next chapter, I'd be like, how could you wrap up everything so quickly?
Yeah, it would be hard.
Yeah.
There's a lot to do and a lot that needs to be said, and people you need to see. We need to know who's alive and who's not, and we need to see camp and what camp looks like and all of that. So,
yeah
I'm glad, too, that we've got a few more chapters to wrap it all up. Okay, so that, we are done with this chapter, and that we are officially done with the Battle of Manhattan.
Yes.
From here on out, it's all the aftermath. So
right.
The battle has ended, and now we will see how it goes from there in the next chapter. But we do have our favorite quotes and our favorite moments. I'm going to do mine first. It's Grover, and it's as Percy is handing Luke the knife. Grover says, Percy? Are you, And Percy fills in the blanks and in his head says, crazy? Insane? Off my rocker? Probably.
That was a good line.
Right? So good.
Yeah.
And what was yours?
Mine was also a Percy and Grover moment. And I'll just read it as it's printed in the book. It says, "We've got to run," I said. "I don't suppose you mean away," Grover murmured hopefully. I sprinted toward the palace, Annabeth right behind me. "I was afraid of that," Grover sighed, and clip-clopped after us. Again, Arian is just filling my image of Grover, and this is just so funny. A little tiny bit of levity in the middle of everything going on.
Mm-hmm. It's going to be... can be.
Yeah, and this is very Grover to me. The guy who's like, I don't really want to go into battle, but like, I guess if you guys are... Like,
are you sure we have to run towards danger? Again? Really? Okay. I love it. Okay, and then our favorite moments. Mine was Annabeth holding Kronos at bay with her knife to try to talk to Luke. There's just something about that moment before it all goes, you know,
it's very pivotal.
And she is so brave and so strong in that moment to do it all by herself, because Percy is just standing there basically gawking at her.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, yeah, get it, Annabeth. So that's definitely my favorite. What was yours?
Poseidon Tyson arriving on scene. Just iconic.
It's so great.
It is great.
It's so great. And I mean, that was the turn. I mean, we talked in the last chapter about Percy, like, sitting on Poseidon's throne and talking to him and being like, this is what has to happen. And ta-da, it worked.
Yeah.
Percy's a little genius.
Thank goodness.
All right. So, yep, that wraps everything up for this chapter, and we'll read chapter 20 next time. Prophecy Radio is produced by Subjectify Media. Follow our website on Twitter, Facebook, Tumblr, and Instagram at Subjectify Media, or visit us at SubjectifyMedia.com. We are home to 3 other podcasts as well. If you like revisiting your favorite canceled and cult classic shows, consider tuning into Rewatchable for in-depth discussions about Firefly, Veronica Mars, Avatar The Last Airbender, Buffy, and Angel, and many more. We also have Not About the Weather, which is a general interest show that sometimes features interviews with our favorite creators. Lastly, we also have Not Another Teen Wolf podcast, which has discussed every episode of the show, contains exclusive interviews, and will be covering the upcoming Teen Wolf movie. You can contact Prophecy Radio directly on Twitter at Prophecy Podcast, or on Instagram, Facebook, and Tumblr at Prophecy Radio Podcast. You can also email your long-form thoughts to prophecyradiopodcast@gmail.com. You can find our episodes on Spotify, Apple, or any of your favorite podcast platforms. Please consider leaving us a review or a rating. 5-star reviews really help others to find us, and that would be awesome. You can leave us questions and comments or ideas for episodes or content you want to hear from us in any of these places, and we'll definitely check it out. We do have one bit of feedback this week from Just a Positive Guy, and I'll let Karen take that one.
I basically just asked, you know, any thoughts on the illustrated edition, the graphic novel, and at A Positive Guy 19 says, "I love the illustrated edition. It's so gorgeous." Gotta agree.
Love. Yeah. Yeah. No, we agree. We definitely agree. As we, I think, made clear.
We made it pretty clear.
All right. So next week is going to be our big news roundup, getting all that early January news that may have piled up while we were taking a little break. So if you come across anything, feel free to send it to us on Twitter, and we will add it to our list of things to discuss when we do that episode.
Yeah.
Until then, this is Kristen.
And I'm Karen.
And we're Prophecy Radio, signing off. Over and out.